Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film
Conversation.
Hooray!
Hooray! Woo! Woo!
Hooray is right. For I am Richard Nicholas. Hello. That's why they're hooraying. And you can also cheer because here is Abigail Bain.
Hello.
Woo! Woo!
And Anthony Evans.
Hi there.
Woo!
Woo! So once again, guys, we're gathered around our old computers to talk about films and record our voices to create a podcast to put on the internet for film fans to listen to and or podcast fans. With that said, let's begin our show. We are here to talk about Plunkett and McLean. Couldn't remember the name for a sec, but I've remembered now. And it was my choice, so I had no excuse for forgetting. Anthony, could you give the details so people are not, like, looking up the wrong Plunkett and McLean film?
Yeah, I certainly can. Okay, so Plunkett and McLean from 1999 is the British film starring Robert Carlyle and Johnny Lee Miller as two highwaymen in the 18th century England who are from different ends of the social spectrum who enter into a partnership to rob the aristocratic of London.
The aristocratic, is that like a term for all aristocrats?
Yes.
It just sounds weird.
I can change it to the aristocrats of London, if you like.
No. Just stick with what you said.
Okay. Plunkett and McLean also stars Ken Stott, Tommy Flanagan, Michael Gambon, Liv Tyler, Stephen Walters, and many little, very small cameos from lots of comedians like Matt Lucas and David Walliams. Alexander Armstrong, Ben Miller. There's a lot of people in this film.
There's even a very tiny cameo from the yet, at the time, yet to be famous. Can you be yet to be famous in the past? The yes. Then unfamous Noel Fielding is in it as well, as a small brothel goer.
Who was mildly perturbed in the background.
Yeah.
To no consequence. What's going on out here?
Yeah.
Pretty much exactly what he said.
It's on the same level as the Dave Gorman appearance in 24-Hour Party People as yeah. The jumping postman. But yeah, this it's a good selection of people of the British acting world, and I think pretty well cast. The reason, I'll tell you why I picked it. I picked it because it's good, and I enjoyed watching it the first time. And I've owned it on VHS for a bit, and I have yet to purchase it on DVD, but we watched it on a special online video provider. I think I can say, Netflix, there, I'm officially sponsoring the podcast.
Let the money roll in.
Anyway, I watched it probably at the time, enjoyed it, have watched it since. One of the main reasons I like it is because it's a period drama, but it's not all musty and old and boring like so many of them are, though I still enjoy musty, boring ones sometimes. It's kind of exciting and modernized, and it doesn't care about being exactly accurate. It kind of has modern music and, you know, a different feel, editing pace. You know, it's more energized and it's different, and it captures that highway robbery thing in a more exciting way than, you know, lots of period dramas do. So what were you guys expecting when I suggested it? Let's start with you, Abigail.
I had seen it before. I remember, once I was reminded of it, I remembered that I liked it. But for some reason or other, I'd sort of forgotten about it until you suggested it. But as soon as you said it, I was like, oh yeah, Plunkett and McLean. Oh.
Well, you're a fan of Johnny Lee Miller a little bit. One of the few fans, probably.
Oh, that's not fair.
No, he's all right. It's just he hasn't, you know, stood the test of time very much, has he?
I don't know. He's in Elementary, is that what that's called? That's doing well.
Oh, I take it back.
What do you mean about John Lee Miller?
Johnny Lee Miller is fine and dandy. It's just he's not known for his acting prowess. And he doesn't have a huge fan base. He probably has a cult fan base, perhaps. I don't know. But you're a fan of him, and I mean, you know, you like British actors generally. Why wouldn't you? You're British. It's very patriotic of you.
What am I supposed to say to that?
Yes, Richard. I am the Winston Churchill of film reviewers. Ah, say what you want. Well, so you had forgotten about it a bit.
Yeah, I think it's because, as you say, in the transition from video to DVD, some stuff just sort of dropped off the radar a little bit. And this was one of them. And I have no idea why. It's good.
Yeah. I mean, it popped up on, you know, Netflix. And I was like, oh, this is something I loved and yet don't have on DVD and should. And then I watched it and went, oh, do you know what? I'm going to put this in my wish list. I'll get this. And I won't watch it for ages now because we've watched it for this. But still, I think it's a good one. And what did you think, Anthony, then?
I heard of this before. I can vaguely remember from when it came out, like, it being a thing. But the only thing I remember was that it was about highwaymen in the 18th century. And that sounded a bit, well, like you said, it sounded a bit dry and musty. But I was expecting something, because it's a British film, something a bit cheaper, if you know what I mean. Something a bit harsher, because that's the general kind of style of
what,
like,
we do.
British films, isn't it? So I was kind of mildly surprised by this. It was a very quirky film, very funny, very, very modern. Like, when I looked up, it was made in 1999. It seemed even more modern than that. Like, it certainly has streaks of 90s painted all over it, certainly. But it still kind of feels quite fresh.
Yeah, what do you mean?
It's got style, darling.
So, yeah, I guess I was expecting your kind of typical view of this kind of period drama, like you were saying before.
There's something about British people putting on wigs and doing 18th century stories that you just think, oh, it's going to be a drag. Someone's going to die in a lake. There's going to be brooding, backstabbing, but it's all going to be in, you know, ancient corridors and just a little bit too dusty and cobwebby. And just, you know, dark rooms, candles and boredom. And it's not. It's rowdy and fun and humorous. That's what's good about it, is it's such a funny, like, story. It's done, you know, in a way to help get you to... It helps, you know, it really is done in a way to make you enjoy the characters and the situations.
Mm.
And, you know, it's very much a comedy crime movie. I wouldn't say it's quite Guy Ritchie does a period drama, because he's kind of done that now with sort of doing Sherlock Holmes type stuff, but it's slightly better than Guy Ritchie films, which can be a little bit hackney now in the current climate, I would say.
I think this, like, it's a bit less gritty than Guy Ritchie movies, and that's what makes it superior in my mind.
But it was in that time where it was fashionable to make fun crime movies where British people bish, bash and bosh, and you know, it was good because it was a period drama. It meant there was some awesome wig opportunities. Like, not since we'd chatted over Amadeus have we had such grand wigs of so many varieties and so many splendid shapes and sizes and colours and stuff.
And many a fine hat too.
Yeah, that's true. And face corn. There was some face corn action in the tailor shops and things. So, I mean, having already said I liked it, I liked it this time. It didn't suffer from age. I enjoyed it again, and you guys enjoyed it.
I think I might have liked it better this time than the previous time, because I'm sort of old enough for it. While there is stuff in it that, you know, you'll get when you're younger, there's also these other elements that you also have to be a little bit older to really appreciate.
I think you have to have an idea of the time period and a better historical knowledge to help you appreciate how lighthearted and fun it's being. Like, it's kind of, you have to be old enough to have accumulated a bunch of period dramas for it to be a refreshing change in tack, I think, anyway.
Mm.
I think that helps. So I guess we should talk a little bit about the main thrust of the plot, because it's about two highway robbers, essentially, and their perception in the media, and just how things pan out for them, really, because one is a career criminal who was previously an apothecary and has taken a line in, you know, robbing from people. And the other is a sort of lower class-ish gentleman. It's sort of the bottom end of the gentleman spectrum. And he's fallen on hard times because he's a gambler and a drunk. And he's not having a very successful life. But they team up together, essentially. Through and begrudgingly, initially. It takes a while for our duo to really bond and become friends. And their friendship's tested throughout. And I like the introduction because it just goes, so this bloke was in jail and it sucks, but he's sort of pleasantly happy in the filth. And then bang, oh, there's a crash and a big wheel breaks into the like small weird. Do they keep prisons in graveyards? Does that make sense?
I don't know. It was a debtor's prison and it was very small. It seemed just kind of like one room thing.
Solitary confinement.
But it seemed odd to me that they had this, what was probably, I don't know, a tube as a jail for this guy who was just arrested for being a vagrant or whatever.
I don't know, it's just like the ye olde drunk tank.
Sure. And that's crashed into by some highwaymen. And that's kind of our introduction, really, is look, smash, bang, look, there's a cool ruby gem thing. And now someone's going to swallow it and try and murder one of the main characters. Oh no, he's been shot. And, you know, drama and intrigue. It was a very good opener, I think, just because it's so much happens.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. It kind of sets out the ground rules straight away. Like, yeah, this is not your kind of typical kind of period thing. It's got a fair bit of action and some horrible, gruesome bits as well. I believe, the scene progresses where one of them is shot and left behind, and they're being chased by like the main villain of the police piece, Ken Stott. Though it turns out he's going to become the main villain later on, and like he kind of tries to torture him by hitting his wound, and then gouging his eye out in the end. So it kind of lays it all out in front of you. And it's like, here it is. This is what it's going to be for the rest, kind of for the rest of the hour and a half.
It's quite a gruesome thing because in the first part we do get a crash, jewel swallowing, eye gouging, wound provoking. Is that, I don't know if that's the right term. We have grave robbing, corpse mutilating, further jewel swallowing. Like, you know, there's a proper this is disgusting element to it.
But then it's sort of how you assume the times were. You accept it as like, oh yeah, everything was a bit dirty and horrible then.
That's kind of true of the whole thing, actually, is even the slightly more well-off people are kind of dirty. There's no, like, so many period dramas are about rich people because that is more interesting, seemingly, than the story of people who spend their days just shoveling mud around, like, and being poor and dying of plague and stuff. Like, so it's always about rich people. Rich people are always clean. But even in this, some of the rich people are kind of spattered with mud and dirty. It's kind of, you know, everyone's lived in and it feels more real, even though it's kind of a hyper-realistic film overall. Everyone's got costumes that are not pristine, you know?
And then the, one of the richest people in it is afflicted with the pox. So that takes the edge off that as well.
Yeah, and even the hoity-toity snobs and rich people are they're very decoratively dressed and they have quite ridiculous wigs at times and flamboyant clothes, but they're not like perfect rich people. Like they're kind of caricatures of trendy hipsters of the past. You know, they're kind of unusual people as well. No one is like kind of perfect.
Yeah, they're not kind of really shown as superior, just a kind of different side to the grime, if you know what I mean. They're just as bad. Like, the aristocrats are just as bad as, like, the poor kind of criminals that are going around, if not more so in some points.
There's loads of, there's corruption at all levels, and from politicians to, you know, thieves, everyone's a little bit dirty, both figuratively and literally. So, let's hear your thoughts and take on the main characters. We've got Johnny Lee Miller, playing the gentleman highwayman, as he becomes known for being polite and nice to the people they rob. And we've got Robert Carlyle.
Yes.
And he plays the ex-apothecary who can weirdly make chemical lamps light up so that the lighting looks cool in certain scenes. He has that cool ability. But he's an apothecary, more kind of gritty, lower class bloke who, more of a conventional thief, but bright because he has the idea of listening in parties to what people have to say, and then we'll know where they're going to be so we can rob them. That's his thing. He's like, ah, got a scheme for us. What do you make of these two guys side by side along the whole journey?
Well, the first thing I noticed was like, oh, it's Robert Carlyle and Johnny D. Miller, because they must have not long come onto this after both starring in Trainspotting.
Yes, they were both in Trainspotting, as you put it.
And it's quite different from that, I suppose. Well, I suppose it is. Yeah, I don't know. This is a kind of, even though Robert Carlyle is kind of playing the harsher, lower class criminal, he doesn't come off quite as hard or menacing as he does in most things that he's kind of in, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Because there's a slightly lighter side to him in this one.
Well, he's playing the more sympathetic character because he has a more sympathetic background. And he isn't the one, like, to let them down as a duo. Like, Johnny Lee Miller's character, what's his name? I can't remember the name of them. The Gentleway Highwayman is kind of how they're known generally, but what are the characters' names? Plunkett and McLean. Am I insane?
Apparently, yes.
Well, we have Captain James McLean, apparently. I don't know if he's actually a captain. And Will Plunkett.
I think you're born into it, and then, you know, you spend, like, 5 minutes on a ship, and that counts. I think that's how it works in those days.
Clergyman.
Yeah, he wears a tri-corner hat at some point, and that's pretty dirty as well. I love the way they look, actually. When you see them, and it's just like, ah, you're perfectly dressed like a gentleman who has just been through the wash no times and has fallen down in the mud hundreds of times. And then just the brown kind of coat of Plunkett and just his... Like, that's the thing with Robert Carlyle, is he comes across as a thug just on sight. Something about the quality of his hair, his face, and the fact that you'd never be comfortable, would you, if he's in character, that he's not going to shiv you.
Yes, he's a very intense actor most of the time, isn't he?
But you're right in noticing that he was less intimidating in this, probably because he's a more sympathetic character.
Yeah, even though they kind of set him up at the beginning that way, it kind of, by the end, he's the one who comes off as the more kind of honourable character.
Well, I think the key is he doesn't instantly try and kill McLean for trying to, like, rip him off. Conveniently, whenever he's got an opportunity to kind of deal with McLean, they're interrupted by the army or police or whatever, and they have to run off. So he's, and then by the time they get to know each other, they've had reason to bond, I guess, and they have excuses not to off each other. Barbie, what did you make of them as a duo or as actors or whatever?
Well, in regards to Plunkett in particular, he's quite hard and quite coarse until he meets Lord Rochester. And then there's this sort of moment where you would sort of expect him to see Lord Rochester and either spit in his face or punch him, because you expect that kind of reaction. But instead, he's amused by him, and he sort of finds him just this colourful weirdness, and he enjoys it. And I think that's the moment that really endeared me to Plunkett, because he's sort of coarse on the outside, but he's still quite light on the inside.
Yeah, he's fair-minded.
Yeah, he does that kind of constantly, kind of subvert your expectations, because that's a good one, because there's a lot of points where he's just kind of thrust into something where you think, like, well, the obvious thing to do, like, in a film is for them to lash out and for them to pretend to be hard, but he just kind of finds it all amusing and kind of laughs a lot of the stuff off.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's kind of bemused by the upper classes in it because they're so ridiculous, both in their fashions and appearances sometimes, and their attitude. And I think he just, you know, he prefers to just laugh at them than to get annoyed. And, well, let's talk about Alan Cumming a moment, because him as Rochester is quite the entrance he makes. I mean, he's in a kind of ludicrous avant-garde purple hat. He has kind of geisha white makeup, and he's kind of the most flamboyant character of a bunch of flamboyant characters that appear in the various hobnobby parties. But he is kind of an out and proud, I don't know, bisexual gay man who likes to dress incredibly and flamboyantly. And I mean, wow, what an impact he makes, right?
Yes.
I want to give an acting credit to that hat alone. But he just, you can tell he's really enjoying himself. And yeah. I always like someone's performance more when they're clearly having the best time doing it.
He looks like he's the original, like, the even more original New Romantic, like the first ever New Romantic with his amazing look and an incredible purple hat that he, you know, he changes up, he has it different, he has different hats, he just never lets an outfit get too old. Like, he's always looks impeccably flamboyant in every scene. I mean, and, like, he's obviously playing a gay character, but he doesn't, it's not about him being gay, it's about him being different to everyone. It's kind of, he kind of wears his uniqueness on his sleeve, and quite cuffed, wonderful, colourful sleeves at times. Yeah. But, like, he's more about, he's kind of an alternative upper class kind of, he's kind of more of a hipster in a sense.
Yeah,
about him being gay or anything.
Perhaps more kind of like someone more indulgent or a hedonist rather than someone who's just simply like just a gay person, if, like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, hedonist is the right term, yeah.
Like, just enjoys excess and pleasure kind of thing.
And because everyone is caked in mud on Brown, he stands out particularly well. Anyway, I really enjoy the relationship between Plunkett and Rochester. I think it works well, and it sets them up as anti-heroes rather than villains that are going to... It doesn't have to build to some kind of crescendo where these horrible thieves get what's coming to them. It's very much about rooting for the thieves because the people they're ripping off are so obnoxious and corrupt. And it's a good kind of little relationship they all share. Like, because essentially Rochester knows McLean from his previous slightly better off days when he was more of a successful gentleman, but he's still aware that he's fallen on bad times. But, you know, like at this point when they meet, they're trying to, they've united and they're trying to kind of get back into a life of gentlemen so that they can find targets to steal from. But yeah, so we all like enjoyed the characters. Johnny Limmiller is both kind of annoying because he's supposed to be frustratingly like betraying his friend and yet charming and enjoying his life. He's kind of more about trying to have a reputation and indulge and gamble, and he's not thinking about the future as much, isn't it? That's the kind of dynamic with him. Like, him, he is indulgent and is doing it for the image, and Plunkett is kind of trying to save enough money to get out of Britain and live in America.
Yeah, it's kind of like, as a duo, like, what they're trying to do is kind of subvert the kind of aristocratic thing and then use it to their advantage, but then he is also then kind of slipping into it himself, because that's kind of just what he's always wanted, I guess.
Yeah, he wants to be kind of, not really so much respected, but kind of, He wants the reputation of this gentleman highwayman. He kind of likes living the life of the upper classes while being a kind of cool media figure who people don't know who he is, but has this reputation amongst the common folk as this gentleman highwayman. And you know, Plunkett's a bit more down to earth, but he still needs McLean to get into this world and have some access. Abby just sneezed in the other room.
I wonder what that noise was.
So let's go back a little bit, because I feel like we've skipped over quite an interesting beginning after the dramatic grave robbing and gem swallowing, essentially our duo gets arrested, and upon being transported to the prison, a gentleman who knows McLean is being led to his coffin and his execution, but is trying to do so in a dignified and stylish manner, and manages to get McLean upgraded.
If you can call it that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can call it an upgrade, because it's the cell that Plunkett goes to.
is
akin to, like, do that scene in Aladdin where Jafar is dressed up like an old man. It's almost the exact same cell with the same cellmate. It's like a horrible, gritty, grotty prison hall with crippled, dying people in. And McLean is in the dusty and horrible but upper-class prison with a bunch of interesting chaps with wigs and dirt. Like, again, we got, like, the upper class, because it's prison. They're all filthy and they're all a bit mad and living as decadently as they can, given that it's a kind of, they're eating fruit, but it's probably not that nice fruit. And they got, they're having a nice enough time considering it's a horrible prison.
It's got my favourite period drama, old man.
Go on.
In it. Upstairs in the rich bit, there's this guy who I only ever see in period dramas, dressed in the sort of clothes he was in and in the sort of wig he was in. And he talks something like this, and he's always shouting and not understanding what's going on. And he's in the Oliver Twist adaptation that I really like, and I love seeing him. I'm happy to have him around.
Me and Abby have an Oliver Twist adaptation on DVD. I don't know who are the name. Andy Serkis is in it. Who else is in it, Abby?
Robert Lindsay.
Robert Lindsay, yes. Yeah, I mean it's kind of
there's loads of people.
Yeah, there's loads. This is from the late 90s, I think, and it was on like ITV or something. And it's a really good version of Oliver Twist. And that guy is in it, and he's brilliant in Oliver Twist, because he has the best line, where he gets to go, "I can't eat and listen, not anymore, not at the same time." And it's just so funny, and he's kind of a scene stealer in this, because he's mumbling nonsense, and he's the winner of their ridiculous bet. Johnny Lee Miller is enjoying himself partly with these upper class crusties, and is bedding the jailer's daughter, who's a kind of slightly troubling-looking young woman who he's bedding her, and they're taking bets on who's going to whip their cream first, I think they say. And this is where our cameo from Matt Lucas and David Walliams. So, they're all shouting and being ridiculous caricatures of upper-class prisoners and crazy people. And this is where Plunkett has interjected himself, really, is into their upper-class prison area, is he's managed to get himself delivered there as a sort of, as a servant to McLean or something, and he has to talk to him. And basically he needs to strike a deal about the gem that he currently has in his bowels. And we just find ourselves in this upper-class prison, which I think is a tremendous location and scene.
I think that's probably the most indicative of the character of this movie, is when Plunkett finally manages to pass the gem, that McLean just very quietly goes, "It's a boy."
No, it's a girl, because they're going to name it Ruby.
Oh, yes.
See?
Quite right.
It's full of jokes, that's what's good about it. Bit of scatological humour there, and Ruby-based puns. Anyway, this is the scene where they kind of, this bargain is just to get the ruby so that they can, McLean can work his upper-class hoity-toityness, get them out of the prison by bribing the guy who runs the prison, I guess. And that could have been the end of their relationship, but when they are out in the real dirty, topless, bare-knuckle boxing, pigs everywhere world, when they're back out in dirty old Britain...
Mm.
They are going to part ways, but essentially the arrival of Armstrong and Miller in their ridiculous powdered wigs causes McLean to reconsider his relationship with Plunkett, which is it's quite a good scene as well, is essentially he's knocked on the ground by these upper class gits who sound tremendously weird given the context, and they kind of, I don't know, how does it go down, guys?
Well, it's just, I think he's kind of, like, McClane's kind of hesitant at first because he doesn't want to be associating with, like lower class people, and he wants to be a gentleman, but they kind of come along and kind of remind him that that's not going to happen, and that he is, you know, in the dirt and lower than them, and they'll never see any different unless he changes something.
It's so funny as well, because just the way it happens is because he gets knocked on the ground and he's like, oh, he gets like all cross, and then these two like just hoity-toity losers turn round and go, ooh, hello, and they like get like brandish a knife and behave like complete ponces, but still manage to sort of put him in his place. I just love it for its ridiculousness.
Yeah, they were. I think they were the most kind of like least subtle kind of in your face kind of, okay, this is a bit odd, them doing some weird kind of posh kind of 90s slang going on.
It's weird because it's a prototype of the airmen who speak in the wrong vernacular.
From the Armstrong and Miller sketch show they made.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
So it's the same thing. They've been doing it the whole time, and I just never seemed to notice that that was Armstrong and Miller's thing.
Yeah, because these two, like, big-wigged, like, kind of upper-class, tough boys, you know, and because they're stylish and from a time where you're trying to put yourself forward as on-trend and ahead of everyone else and cool, they sound like kind of wrong because they are saying things that are sort of a variation on 90s scenesters or something. And they just like, camp kind of geezer, kushti. They're kind of camp and odd and wrong. But it feels right because it's an updating and modernizing of a tale like this. It fits with the music and the style and the editing and the tone. It doesn't try and create absolute realness, and they're kind of, like you say, Abby, prototype sketch characters, like, of what they later get together and do, which is their famous like airmen who talk like, you know, kids from the OEs. But yeah, I think they're a great double act to have made a cameo in. So again, like, two great cameos from double act comedians.
Yeah, I'd say at this point as well, they never, the film never goes too overboard with like kind of the modernization. It's like, I think the main kind of thing they have is that Robert Carlyle's character, Plunkett, is a kind of like chemist. So like most of the kind of fanciful, weird kind of anachronistic, what's the word I'm looking for there?
Anachronistic
things like come from him, but it's nothing unreasonable. It's always kind of like, oh, I can make smoke and fireworks and fancy kind of potions.
And then it's in the music, like they have like kind of dancey music that feels like it suits the scenes where they're kind of doing old-fashioned dancing, but it's got a kind of synthy beat to it, so it's obviously not correct. And actually, some of the music I would like to talk about, another cameo as well, is some of the songs throughout are by a band called the Tiger Lilies, which are kind of a alternative kind of cabaret band that are quite good, really. I recommend the Tiger Lilies. But they have a kind of interesting style, because it's a guy with a very high-pitched voice and is singing, and they have quite macabre songs.
Yeah, it's got kind of, they have kind of flavours of like kind of old-timey music.
Yeah.
But it's also like very alternative and modern. I really like the soundtrack in the whole film, actually. It's kind of one of those ones where I just kind of like to have the soundtrack.
Yeah. You should check out the Tiger Lilies then, because they do a couple of key songs, and they make a small appearance in one of the brothels. They're like they're playing live. We briefly go past them.
Okay.
And yeah, they're just a really interesting sound, because it's like is it accordion like that you play, and like, you know, just a kind of cabaret style, but with a punk kind of influence.
Yeah.
And it creates this mishmash of old and new, which suits the whole film. And it's kind of the soundtrack is very much a Tiger Lily's influenced one. And it's one of the great factors about it is it's not overblown. It's like, it feels right, but it's slightly off, isn't it? That's the thing it always seems to do. And it's because it's a comedy, you totally forgive it. You're not, you know, at no point
exactly.
You're like, this is serious.
And it's from the 90s, and there's a very kind of 90s things going on. Yeah. Like, there's a lot of kind of, when there is kind of modern music, it's kind of dancey kind of techno, or that kind of alternative kind of rock that was starting back in the day.
Yeah, so once we have the decision that Plunkett and McLean are now going to go ahead with their plan, which is to dress up and pass as gentlemen. So they need an address, they need clothes, they have a nice shopping montage where Plunkett punches people who measure him wrong, and Lee Miller gets to look like he's enjoying every moment of trying on every like suit that's both smart and somehow ridiculous looking. We have plenty of more powdered wigs from all the people in the fashionable shops, face cones being used, powder going everywhere. You know, we have a brilliant montage of let's get gentlemanly, but in the 1800s. I really enjoy that. And then again, the fast-paced kind of style comes in the editing and music with that.
Yeah, I think you mentioned like kind of Guy Ritchie before. And it is like that's when, whilst watching this film, that's a name that definitely came to mind. Sometimes because of kind of the kind of fast paced and the kind of dark humor that's kind of running out throughout the film, but also kind of, I suppose it's a kind of response to Tarantino as well.
Yeah.
Coming from like the early 90s. There's even like a slow, like right at the beginning, there's like a slow motion shot of a gun being fired, which has got a touch of the Matrix to it as well.
Mm. Yeah. It feels very much like, of its era. It's very 90s, and yet somehow, because it's playing the 1800s, it's kind of timeless and enjoyable. It doesn't feel too... I mean, it feels dated in the correct way, I guess. But yeah, their plan, you know, makes sense, and it leaves for a lot... Well, essentially, the film becomes many of their attempts at robbery. So it's fancy parties with these hoity-toity rich people, and it's then them ripping them off. It's them pulling over coaches or turning up at the parties they're having and robbing them and building their confidence, reputation. And then also kind of crucially to the plot, meeting the love interest of McLean, who is a young, rich, privileged woman who is the daughter of a corrupt Michael Gambon is a corrupt politician, and his daughter is Rebecca, played by, what's her name?
Liv Tyler.
Liv, that's such a weird name, Liv Tyler. Liv,
yeah.
And essentially...
And she's kind of like kind of rebellious herself. She's not looking for like the perfect kind of upper crust gentleman. She's looking for someone with a bit of edge to them.
I mean, she correctly hates all the people in her social circle because they're all portrayed like complete, you know, idiots and toffs and horrible people. And then it's the more exciting option is these scallywag highwaymen, but who are also gentlemanly, you know. Abby, what did you make of the kind of story around Michael Gambon, his daughter? And I guess we haven't yet talked about him. Ken Stott's character is the sort of lead investigative police army bloke.
Well, first of all, I'm really annoyed Jamie isn't here because we to tease Jamie for how much he looks like Ken Stott.
You think? do you actually think so? Because I've always been of the opinion that our currently missing spoiler-filled member, Jamie, is a little bit like Ken Stott. Maybe like related to Ken Stott, or he will eventually look like Ken Stott because they're not quite the same age. But I think he looks a bit Ken Stott-ish. And do you agree, Abby, or are you just...
I've always agreed.
Anthony, do you see any of Jamie in Ken Stott?
I see what you mean.
And he's not here to defend himself.
They, in the film, they actually do quite a good job of... They attempt to make Ken Stott's character...
Mr. Chance.
A little bit more likeable. Because Rebecca doesn't like him, which is fair. But she's just outwardly rude to him, which... As a British audience, we would go, well, you can't do that. I don't care how much you don't like someone, you can't be rude.
But he's still slimy and obnoxious, and the fact that he thinks he's interesting enough for her to take even the slightest bit of notice of is... you're right, though. There is a bit of, you don't have to ignore him.
And in a way, you sort of feel like, well, maybe people were a bit nicer to him. He'd be a bit nicer as well. Come on, let's all work together on this a bit.
Yeah, because I suppose he, like, they don't mention it much, but he's got the same kind of thing going on as McLean, where he's kind of at the lower end of kind of gentlemanly, and he's trying to kind of work his way up the best he can. So there's a bit of a parallel there, I suppose.
But because he's a lawman, he should, in a sense, be the, not the protagonist, but he should be the one, you know, good moral people should be happy for. People are thieves and people are lawmen, and we should, you know, he doesn't technically do anything corrupt other than, oh no, wait, he's got a reputation for doing stuff outside of the law, isn't he? So he's a corrupt policeman, because it's implied that he does stuff without, not to the letter of the law. He takes the law into his own hands. But in the film, he's essentially just trying to track down some highwaymen, which is fair enough that he should, and that's correct. So, but we don't sympathize with him because he's an obnoxious, slimy character, and he's such a git. He's a very convincing villain, is Stott.
Yeah.
There's something intimidating and horrible about him in every scene.
He's very menacing in this film.
And, you know, that nose helps.
Yeah, and he's got that thing where of kind of he could turn at any moment, so he's always got that kind of tension when he's on screen.
Yeah, he's just just perfect for the role of, like, horrible lawman villain.
There is, it's something about Ken Stott's eyes, I think. He can look at you in a certain way that just tells you that if you say anything else, he is going to rip you to pieces.
Well, he's very firm with his own men, because there's quite a scene where he beats up his own, like, one of his men in the... They're failing to stop these highwaymen, and he's got all of his men lined up, and one of them says something, and he makes example out of it, out of one of his men, by forcing him to eat his pay, and then poking him in the eye and kicking him when he's down. And it really, you know, paints him as this man who takes pleasure in other people suffering, and is a menace who enjoys suffering, really. So very unsympathetic as a lawman. I mean, Gambon as well is another villain of the piece. He's a tremendously horrible wig. Like, it's sort of, why are you wearing a wig that is so hideous and unflattering? Like, it's huge, but such a horrible kind of mustardy, dusty colour. And he's just unpleasant. But Michael Gambon is very good at being this kind of delicious, dislikable person as well, I think.
Yeah, and he doesn't get much screen time compared to, like, everyone else. But, like, what he has, he kind of, like, eats up.
Well, his key things are his arrogance in the political arena, the fact that he's in everything for, he's just doing everything selfishly for himself, and the fact he can turn a blind eye to his own daughter potentially raped by Ken Stott. That's pretty horrible. So you don't really feel too bad when he gets murdered by Stott later on.
Not at all.
Or Chance, as it, technically correct.
One thing I did want to bring up, though, is the kind of, is Liv Tyler, and she's fine. Like, she does a good job. She looks beautiful, and she's very cunning and whatnot, and she plays the part well. But I don't know if I quite totally buy the relationship between her and McLean.
Yeah, because she's like a giddy fan to some extent. She's harsh to him sometimes, and is kind of partly onto him, maybe. But she's secretly in love with this highway robber image that's been portrayed. And, you know, the fact that he's been gentlemanly and given back some of her jewellery to her. You know what I mean? Like, she is in love with him. But is it that strong a female character? Is that what you were saying, or do you have some other point, Anthony?
Well, no, just not that. It's just kind of like you mainly kind of see her just kind of being romantic about the highwayman, and sort of maybe hinting that she kind of is on to them. But then I think there's a scene later on where she's threatened, her and her father are threatened, and they have to leave. And then she goes to McLean to, like, bring him with. And it's like, well, I don't quite see the step you've taken here, if you know what I mean. I don't quite buy the relationship.
Yeah, why are you so, Like, you're a bit in love with him, but you don't really know him.
Yeah.
Also, there's many times where it looks as if she's betrayed them, and they kind of think that. There's times where she's supposed to be meeting them or setting up an opportunity for them to either help her out. You know, there's lots of times where they're going to meet, and she's not there, and that causes them to either be, like, arrested or shot at, or they get into trouble lots of times, and that should make them think that she's not trustworthy, and yet, you know, McLean keeps wanting to find her and save her, despite not knowing if she's to be trusted or not. It's a bit odd.
Yeah. So it's like, I see it from his angle.
Yeah.
But not so much hers.
Right.
So it doesn't distract or anything. It's not terrible. It's not a huge flaw. But it's one of the few things that I noticed, which was a bit just, I don't quite know if I buy this or not.
What about you, Abby? What do you make of the Rebecca relationship character?
Well, she does get into the whole idea of the thing pretty fast and pretty hard. But at the same time, it is obvious that he's the best choice available to her.
Yeah.
She does need rescuing from that world a little bit.
And whether or not it has any longevity, we could probably argue. But I totally get why she would really latch onto it as much as she did. And that she would go to the extent that she did, because...
Well, she wants some excitement, perhaps.
Yeah, what else has she got, really?
Yeah, hoity-toity hobnobs and obnoxious, lecherous men, and, yeah, it's not great. Yeah, so, what I think is a plus point for her is she is not just a damsel in distress, because there are times where, you know, she, I think, helps out at the execution at the end. She manages to, like, pull a gun on someone and save Rochester's life, and she sort of she's not just useless, she is actively trying to, you know, get involved, but then she's a love interest and that is her role, so she's not going to be too proactive in any other way. So, you know, like, maybe some reservations, but we're still all on board. There's no deal breakers about any of the things so far.
No.
And there's some really enjoyable robberies. It's almost a montage, again, of robberies and various, like, you know, it's always cool to see people pull old-fashioned guns and have firefights and, you know, it's, and, like, horses rearing up and, you know, various cars, not cars, but what were they, like, carts crashing and things. Like, it's got lots of different scenes, lots of tremendous costumes, and then the jokes and humour throughout in each of these scenes, whether it's, like, sex jokes in, like, one of the parties, or, like, the kind of, the in one of the well-to-do parties, again, Armstrong and Miller are there, and they think it might be part of the show of the fireworks, is they're having, like, a robbery, like, they're sort of being entertained by being robbed for some reason. And I really enjoyed how it plays out for a while. I enjoy inhabiting that world for a bit, if you know what I mean.
I think it's good that, to an extent, we look at the world through the lens of Rochester, because you feel a bit better about what they're doing, because they are picking out the people in that society that are particularly deserving of the treatment that they get. You don't know until later on, but the Chief Justice just lets Chance get up close with his niece, and the rich woman has the pox and is generally repugnant.
Yeah, she's a kind of horrible character. She uses people for sex and is a rich person and therefore horrible. Like, I don't know. She has some ridiculous hats as well. She brings up the hat counter.
And when they rob the party, they have to rob Rochester because he is present, but then later on, they give it back to him?
Yeah, kind of, because Plunkett's all right with him, and he's assisted in their escape as well, there's a moment of kindness where he gives this pendant or whatever back to Rochester as a sign, like, I know you said it was for your mother, so I shouldn't take it. I had to, and because we are friends, here you go, we are all cool. Like, and that's a really nice moment. And it Rochester's good because, amongst all the toffs, he is one of the decent ones, even though he's a fashionista and avant-garde.
Yeah, even though he's probably, like, the biggest and the worst one, he's still, like, the most decent one.
Yeah, he's a decent person. He's not corrupt in any way. He's just enjoying his life as best he can. given his privilege. And that he was key. I think that's one of the key points to it not being a like poor versus the rich thing, which would have been kind of a bit more obnoxious if it had just been rich people are bad, poor people are good. So, it's all exciting. We've got the thing where Mr. Chance is trying to, set up stings or try and, find out who they are. McLean is being a bit careless at times. Like, he's kind of enjoying the showmanship so much. He's letting his guard down a little bit and causing problems. And it kind of culminates, really, in them being set up for a robbery that goes wrong. And they kind of have to decide, are we going to leave it at that and go to America now and stuff, isn't it? Does anyone else want to talk about how it kind of comes? I mean, we actually kind of have... We have a part, actually, where at a brothel, where they are enjoying themselves, generally, we have Plunkett confront Mr. Chance by chance. It's not on purpose. He's just being abusive to a prostitute, as you do. And
I love that, because he was wearing a girdle.
Yeah. I suppose we should also mention at this point that it was also Mr. Chance right at the beginning, in the beginning scene, who like was torturing Plunkett's original kind of accomplice.
Yeah.
So he's got even more kind of reason to hate him.
Yeah. It's interesting, actually, because in the opening scene where Plunkett's accomplice eats the jewel and is essentially betraying Plunkett to try and keep the money for himself, and he confesses it as he's dying to Plunkett. Plunkett doesn't seem that concerned and wants to rescue him still. So all the way through, Plunkett is seen as this nice guy, even though he's a thief. And even his backstory is that he used to be an apothecary and he's lost his wife. And, she died, his business is gone, and he's down on his luck. So he's a very sympathetic character. And it builds to a kind of duel between when he stops Chance beating up a woman in the brothel. It causes, it essentially leads to a duel that they're going to have as gentlemen, I suppose, which has a really hackneyed, silly bit in it where it's like, do all period swashbucklers have to have a bit where someone gets shot and then they unveil something in their top pocket that saved their life?
Yes, it's kind of, if it's not in there, it's not a proper film.
Yeah. Like, for some reason, everyone gets shot in the heart, but wait, they have a pocket watch or a canteen, or in this case, a Bible. It's a great moment, actually, where Chance just gets up off the ground after being shot and holds up the Bible and just goes, "Thank the Lord!" Because at no point does he tease actually being a Christian man. And it's just like, in your face. It's my shot, mate. I'm entitled to my shot. I am entitled to my shot. Pachow! Oh, I only got him in the arm. Rivalry! That's my summing up of that bit.
It was good.
That was one of those moments as well where maybe it's a Scottish thing. But right. Ken Stott and Robert Carlyle both have this excellent stare where it's just, oh, you shot me, did you? Come at me. And when they're staring at each other, it's just like, yeah, I know you probably have to fight, but please don't fight.
Yeah. I think one of the successes of the story is good actors, funny actors, like a great casting overall, some tremendous period costumes. And then on top of that, you've got a very tight script. You've got two stories, despite me thinking it's a bit cheesy to have like something in top pocket saving your life from a bullet. But it's got like two stories going on. It's like Plunkett and McLean are united and are going through their trials and tribulations. And we've got the love interest on McLean's side, and we've got Plunkett's rivalry with Chance on the other. And they both like kind of build to a crescendo. And it's kind of, it ends with a kind of happy ending, but it's a good, exciting journey, and you never quite know where it's going to go. There's always a chance that McLean will betray Plunkett and it'll be a problem and that'll end their relationship. Anyone could die at any point or be hung in some horrible, on the ridiculous gallows. Actually, one of the striking imagery in this is the gallows at the end. The kind of, what do they call it? The Tyburn gallows? Tyburn tree?
It might be tree. because they do the Tyburn jig. It's definitely Tyburn something.
Yes, it's at Tyburn. They have a big triangular gallows where you get strung up after a horse is pulled, and you'd kind of pulled really quickly up by your throat into the gallows, and people throw their hats about or give weird street poetry. Like, there's people performing street poetry, and there's people throwing hats, and there's clapping and rose throwing. It's a very, very, it's a big occasion when people are getting hung in Britain at this time, it seems. But I think it's a very good script, I'm saying. And I think the story is so well paced and told and just well balanced. There's nothing quite out of place that feels too much or too little of anything. What do you guys think?
No, I pretty much agree. But it is the balance of it that really works for it. It puts me in mind of, say, Knight's Tale as well, where if they had picked one more element that was too modern, it would have swerved off in one direction. But they've kept enough of it regular, and they've updated enough of it for it to have the flavour of the time it's in, but can be understood by the modern audience.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a lot like A Knight's Tale, isn't it? Even the music and dance scenes and stuff have that kind of modernising dance synth to it, but yet still slightly old-fashioned. It feels like it's in that genre of modernised period dramas. That's a good point. Also, it features the coolest hat. Like, the woman who has given the pox to McLean after, and then also has been robbed by McLean, turns up at the gallows when he's going to get hung, wearing a fantastic black hat, because, you know, funeral, but it has a replica of the gallows on it, with little men hanging on it, like she's, like, you know, just perfectly macabre and horrible, and so decadent. Really like that hat.
Yeah, there's just, the whole thing is just attention, lots of attention to, like, detail, and that really kind of shows the kind of, like, the care that's gone into it. I remember, like, at the beginning, there's one scene, it's so throwaway, but, like, if you're watching carefully, you can see when they're being led up to the prison, that just all the prisoners are just throwing their poo out the windows at them.
Yeah. And I think we even, like, the prisoner who comes out at the time and is upper class, and he's paying his debts by being hung, I think they later on, they're looking at his legs, he's been hung, and they're staring up at him, kind of deciding what to do with themselves, and everything that's in there is, you know, in there for a reason. It's either a joke or it's significant, and they don't forget things that happened earlier. Everything ties in so nicely. And I mean, part of the enjoyment of the end is a bit spectacular. It's a bit silly as well. So I'm trying to find some flaws, because there are, like, the Bible saving, stopping the bullet thing was a bit mad. And some of the chemistry is a bit, really? Like, but at the end, it's grand and enjoyable. But it borrows a little bit from The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, where it's got that, oh, a man's hanging, but he's been shot down at the last minute. Or, like, it's that kind of, is he going to die? Will someone save him? And then just as he probably already has died, is shot free and is saved.
Looking for things to kind of take umbrage at, I suppose. There, like, after that, there's kind of like one more kind of chase scene through the sewers, and that kind of ends on a slight kind of anticlimax. I wouldn't say an anticlimax per se, but it wasn't as dramatic as it could have been, where you kind of have the kind of final confrontation between Plunkett and Chance, where it's kind of, they've said it, the way it's set up is there is no kind of, no, there is dramatic irony, because we know that Plunkett is kind of faking it.
Yeah.
And that he's just doing this to kind of lure in Chance. But it's kind of, because that was really obvious, then it's like him winning then and pulling out the gun and pretending, going, ha, I'm not actually wounded, was just a bit of an anticlimax.
It was really weird that he let him anywhere near his eye as well. It's like, why did you just thumb his eye for a bit? And then went, does it hurt? Like, what?
Odd. I know what you mean, because like, that particular situation could have been the end game then. It's like, if he comes near my eye, I'm dead.
It was odd, because he decides, quite a reasonable idea, he needs to get the gun on him first. So he lies down pretending to be dead, catches him off guard, fair enough. But it is because he lies there, putting up with Chance like kneeling down and like messing around with him for ages before he even bothers to pull the gun on him. He could have easily poked his eye out, or like Chance could have slit his throat to make sure he was dead before he got a chance. He really waits too long. This is that waiting lot too long at the end that kind of spoils elements. Is at the hanging, like Johnny Lee Miller's strung up and he's choking. Oh, a horse is turning up with loads of smoke coming out of it. Oh, what's going on? Oh, awesome cool action bit where like Plunkett has loads of guns on him and is shooting all the guards. And it's like, well, it's too late because he's dead up there.
He's been hanging for like 5 minutes, yeah.
And when he does come down, the fall will break his legs.
Yeah. And let's be honest, one shot with a rope, I mean, that's a hard shot, even for Clint Eastwood, but he manages to shoot the rope down, he comes down, lands, I mean, like you say, he's concussed, dead, broken-legged, but he still manages to get up and ride a horse off. Rebecca is rescued from Chance, who's as a villain, has to force her to watch him die, which I liked, yeah. Just to make sure what she sees. You know, but it's done with a sense of swashbuckling humour as well. So I'm willing to forgive this slightly filmic ending because it's fun. It's not at any point saying this is serious and we should all know that this was a part of history that happened. It's saying we're just having some fun with this idea of cops and robbers and wigs.
Yeah, and I like the last shot of them kind of the three of them running down the sewer and then out into kind of the light,
essentially getting away and getting to America.
Yeah, which I thought afterwards is kind of like the reverse to the ending of like Batman and Robin
or Bond. Yeah. it's like the start of Bond where you get the little black pinwheel of the sight of the gun, but they're all running away down it.
Yeah, but that was a nice image to end on, I think.
The thing I liked about the ending was they cut back to Alan Cummings' character, Rochester, riding back after he leaves them, decides he's going to stay in England and camp it up and corrupt the young and stuff. And it's just America's not for him. And it's not. You can't turn up in that purple hat and be like, how's it going, guys? How are the natives? Are they all right? You know. But Rochester's going back on his horse and just saying, oh, that was very exciting. I think it's time for me to go to bed. It's quite the day we've had, isn't it, horse? You know, like, and I like that they cut back to that before they went for the kind of iconic visual. Like, I thought that was a nice touch, just to keep the mood light. Another character, Abby, that you quite like, or character actor, I guess, is the bloke who plays Chibs from Sons of Anarchy appears in it. He's in lots of period dramas because he has that perfect look, long hair-ish, medium-length hair, I guess, and scars, and he's just villainous enough.
You are talking about Tommy Flanagan.
Yeah.
Fantastic name.
And he's Chance's kind of head henchman, I guess. He's sort of, he's not that predominant a character, but he still, you know, plays his role.
I think that's one of when you watch it a second time, maybe the times after that, you realise that his performance is very good because he knows to just shut up, do his job, otherwise he's going to get eye gouged or he's going to make him swallow his money.
Yeah. Possibly he learnt his lesson previously when he got this car from chirping up at the wrong time. But I feel a bit sorry for him because he's doing his job and he's in no way corrupt. I mean, he just works for Chance. And then he gets shot at the end by McLean and Rebecca. And it's just like, ah, you didn't get our man on the floor, unlucky. You are now dead in a sewer. But I don't know. I wanted to bring him up because of the connection he had. I mean, he's in a bunch of different things. He's a good actor. But again, he was another, oh, that guy. You know, so it's full of that guy. It's full of good comedians. And it's full of, you know, good costumes and humour. I mean, it's like all round, I found it very entertaining once again. And, you know, I just re-rate it as a fun comedy drama period drama thing.
Yeah, I guess what's more to say? Like, yeah, it was really good. Just, it's a very kind of a modern film. I suppose it's like, it was there at the kind of forefront of when films were kind of becoming more modern, like this was, if you know what I mean. Where they're starting to kind of accept anachronisms more in film. It's funny. It's fast paced. It's got lots of action, but then it's got that kind of Hollywood gloss and cinematography, but it never kind of loses its kind of gritty, horrible kind of British edge either. Mm. The soundtrack works really well. I like the characters. I like the actors. Yeah, it was really good, wasn't it?
Ticks a lot of boxes.
It's been a while since you had a film where I just went, yeah, it's really good.
Abby, have you got any final thoughts before we try and think? I've got a rating for myself that I've been thinking about, but have you got any final thoughts before we all struggle for some kind of metaphorical rating?
Not usually much for sequels, but I think it'll be really interesting to go back to these characters again in America now that time has passed.
Yeah.
To see what they've been up to, and then also what stuff goes wrong that means they have to be in a film again.
Yeah, you could very much see Plunkett, McLean and Rebecca all landing in America and having to forge a new life, maybe rip off more people. And so they kind of come back to maybe they get robbed themselves. They're essentially quite broke anyway. They have the tickets to get to America. So you could see them landing in America, getting up to their old business of like hobnobbing with the aristocrats. Maybe they'll have problems between the aristocrats and the more native people. Like, you know, there's the people who are more American, and then there's the British who are just turning up, and then there's the, you know, Native Americans. So there's an interesting sequel, I think. Plunkett and McLean does America or whatever.
Hmm. Listen up, Hollywood, because we know you're listening. We want a sequel.
So my rating thing is, it is very much like the ruby that gets swallowed a couple of times in the film. It is a gem that has been forgotten about, but everyone who comes across it wants it, but they have to. It's kind of disgusting as well, because it gets covered in blood and it's swallowed and it's, you know, pooped out at times. So it's kind of a beautiful thing that is lost and forgotten and used and is grubby and disgusting but still valuable. Like, it's kind of that mix of wonderful with the and this film is very much wonderful and yet kind of disturbing and dirty and disgusting. So it's kind of like the ruby that is used in the film. See?
Yeah, fair enough. Going on a similar thing, I don't have any particular object or something in mind, but something kind of, something like steampunk, where it's kind of meshing the kind of the old with the new.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Where it's taken something really old and kind of modernized it. And usually kind of 9 times out of 10, it looks horrible and weird. Mm-hmm. But then there's that kind of rare 10th one, like kind of 1 in a million, which is like, actually, this is perfect. It kind of becomes then timeless because of that.
Yeah, that's the thing with steampunk, is it's tremendously popular as a kind of genre or culture, and so many times it's just lame and stupid, and then every now and again it's just, oh, that is cool. I like your upper class robot thing, you know, like, or your sci-fi gun that is somehow powered by coal. Like every now and again, steampunk is very, very cool. And then, you know, so I think this is one of the times where the mishmash of modern and new is good. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah.
So, Abby, you, what do you think?
Ooh.
There were some tremendous giant powdered wigs that we didn't talk about as well, I've just remembered. And especially the whole scene with the sort of Plunkett and McLean with the upper classes after there's been the duel. And there's just these big wigged ladies who are old but upper class, taking an interest, and the woman, Abby. Can you do an impression of her?
Mr. Plunkett, when a man such as you appears in society, the ladies can be quite a flut. She just had the most beautifully pursed lips.
She just squeezes out her accent perfectly, yeah. Sorry, you were coming up with a rating, though.
Oh, I thought you would remember and said, I'll come up with anything. No, I think Anthony sort of nailed it with the whole steampunk thing. It's maybe one of those things where it has to be things that you like in order to enjoy it. So I am perfectly happy to see some sort of aviator dressed in steampunk clothes, but also modern looking at the same time. But then there are other people that might look at this and think it's just silly. It's like, that's why we like it. Leave us alone.
Yeah, like in most kind of steampunk films, it always kind of builds to like a ridiculous contraption at the end, which is just like a bit too ridiculous, and it's like that doesn't really make sense. But like, it doesn't that doesn't happen in this film. Mm. It's just really well balanced, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it doesn't have that moment where it's like, okay, this is a 20,000-foot giant robot run on steam kind of thing. It doesn't get to that point where you're just a bit like, that's a bit ridiculous now.
But even at its like the height of its ridiculousness in this movie, it's still only really that he managed to put a smoke bomb on the back of a horse to shoot a guy down. And really, on the scale of stuff that's ridiculous, it's not that bad.
No, not at all.
And I'm glad to hear you like a film, Abby, where a dog dies, because that was one of the sins they commit.
Dogs die, and thank you so much for reminding me.
Sorry. So every film has a dog that dies in it, basically. Like, one in at least five films. Why do filmmakers kill dogs? It's not good to do it. It's not that dramatic, because it's done in nearly every one of them. But there was no need. The dog should have escaped. Also, in the scene where the French bloke who is robbed dies and his carriage is, they escape into the sewers from this guy's carriage that is shot at. That is another bit I have a problem with. They kind of make no sense that they all start shooting, all the police or whatever, shoot at Plunkett McLean hidden in this, you know, carriage. They don't die, yet they somehow get in the sewer underneath them through the floor of the carriage. Almost instantly.
Yeah. That reminded me of one of our other reviews of The Rookie, where they use the exact same method to like escape from being chased down. And it's like, you shouldn't be making me compare you to The Rookie, because that's never a good thing.
In The Rookie, they didn't leave a bomb in an ornate box as well. As a screw you, and also screw your little dog too. Anyway, I'm sorry for reminding you, Abby, but you know, why can't dogs live in everything? There's no reason to kill them.
No.
It's not dramatic and funny. It's not big, filmmakers. It's not big and clever. So a point off for that, but otherwise a cracking film, yes?
Yes.
You said that like Tim from Bargain Hunt.
See you next time for some more Plunkett and McLeaning, guys! Woof! They sort of kick on Bargain Hunt now, don't they, to finish the show? We'll have to do an audio kick. The spoiler film conversation is over. Hooray! Kick!
Hooray!
Hooray!
Bye.